Good morning. We're having a conversation this morning with Mr. Frank Weltner in Frank and Phyllis Weltner's really beautiful Victorian home in Franklin on Elk Street. It's just a beautiful place. We're very fortunate to be here. And thank you, Frank, for having us. Folks who don't know Frank don't realize that he's had a remarkable life. He is one of those individuals, unique individuals, who's literally seen the world and seen the world in ways that very few of us could ever hope to. And it's given him a perspective on the world and life that makes him just a great guy to have a conversation with. Just quick background, Mr. Weltner was really a former submariner in the United States Navy, came out as a commander, and then after that career, a lengthy career as a submariner, he then went to sea, working for a commercial firm as the master and captain of several vessels that drilled for oil throughout the world, from the North Sea, clear down across the other side of the globe, down into the South Pacific, off of Southeast Asia and into Indonesia. Frank has been around. There's no question about it. And we listen to Frank because, among other things, he has these just great stories. Now, before we get into some of these great stories and the life that you've led, I've got to comment, Frank, about this house. This is kind of legendary. When you bought this house did not look, in the interior at any rate, anything like it does today. It was an apartment house, and you brought it back from almost death. That took a lot of doing, and you did most of it, from what I understand. How'd you know how to do all that?
Well, for one thing, after that introduction, I don't know how I can possibly live up to it.
Yeah.
regarding the house, that at one time did have my apartment. And when I bought it, I had six operating apartments.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to be cleaned up a little bit. And my wife told me that she liked the house and we turned into a really nice home. And I requested the following instructions. So, and I needed a hobby because we had just moved in from San Diego after being out there for 25 years. And I was planning to retire, and I had no idea what I'd be doing with my time. And I enjoyed woodworking, and I thought this would be terrific plaything.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved in and I started to work it over. And for instance, this room that we're in right now at one time was a full apartment.
Hmm.
So I started in the kitchen for it. Have to do the kitchen first. One kitchen, one bathroom, one bedroom is all you need, so that's what we did. And moved throughout the house.
It took you how long to do this, Frank? 5 years?
It's not finished yet.
Oh.
And that was started in January of 88. And the first 2 floors were pretty well done, but practically nothing has been done for the third floor. Took a little thing up there.
Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, you probably don't know this, Lois and I, my wife and I, we first met Phyllis when she graciously came out on this wonderful porch you have here in the front, and she spoke to a group of people taking a tour run by the Rotary, Franklin's Rotary, during Applefest, and it was one of those house tours, the walks that they offered at the time, and the wife came out on the porch, and she said hello to the world. Everybody was from all over the place at the time. And I seem to recall she actually let us in the house at just a short bit. So came aware of Phyllis before we came aware of you, Frank, but that's your partner in life, so you can't just talk about you without mentioning, of course, your wife.
She put up with me. I might have been out of town for the first 2 or 3 years, well until 91. Every now and then I would go to sleep. But, somebody would give me a phone call that I couldn't turn down, so I'd take off for 1 month and 4 months. But
So you may not have been here at the time. You mentioned that you came back to this area after 25 years in San Diego, and I know you were all over. That was your home, but you personally were all over. Let's get back. Let's go into your first, your earlier life. Were you actually born and raised in Franklin, or whereabouts?
No, I was born in June of 27 in Youngstown, Ohio.
Oh.
We lived in Girard at that time. And of course, shortly thereafter, the Depression came in. And my father had a very good job. He was an electrician at one of the larger steel mills. But he contracted the tuberculosis, almost died. So he couldn't work in the steel mill environment anymore. And of course, with the Depression, it was very hard to get anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we lived in various parts of Ohio during the Depression. And occasionally, we would go to my father's homestead, my granddad's farm, and eat our way through the Depression. But, and we wound up in Butler, Pennsylvania, when I was in third grade. At that time, my father was working for the Kalamazoo State Insurance Company. He would set up a retail outlet and train some furnace installers and so forth, and then move on to the next assignment,
mm-hmm.
which turned out to be the Mango County, after that. I spent my second year in the third grade in Butler, because when I was young, I refused to learn English. I enjoyed hunting frogs and turtles and things like that. But school was a total waste of time. But I met my school teacher in the third grade, and it was her very first class. My very first introduction to a large school like they had in Butler. And she was absolutely beautiful. And not only that, she came off of a farm right outside of Butler, a big dairy farm.
Mm-hmm.
And I love dairy farms, that's my neighbor. And we got along great.
Mm-hmm.
And some big kid in the class bad mouthed a little bit. So, recess, I pummeled the living daylight sign. So, stayed in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to stay in after school and clean the blackboard. Now, it don't get any better than that.
Mm-hmm.
I got to spend about 15 or 20 minutes with my new love.
Yes, yes.
So, it was straight A's in Panama.
There you go, Frank.
I found out school wasn't all that bad.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we came up here, we went to school outside of Jackson, the Lincoln School. It was eighth grade by a month. And that was a nice experience. But, and then, 1 year of school in Franklin, and we lived right across the East Street Bridge, and I spent my sophomore high school year in Cranberry. I knew everything that you could learn then in high school, so I joined the Navy in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for formal education.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't learned anything too much.
No, it's been a long time. Maybe you better go back to that grade school in Butler.
Get remotivated.
Right, motivated once again. So, all right, so you went into the Navy in 44, right there towards the end of the Second World War. Up the Great Lakes, I suppose, and then...
No, I went to Sampson, New York.
Oh.
And then I went from Sampson, New York to Norfolk, Virginia, where we had a very large, what they call an outgoing huge missile. And I worked there as a groundskeeper. I had a four-man working club there.
Mm-hmm.
people were waiting around to get a new sign. And ran into an interesting incident there. On weekends, you would be assigned to literally a grid and barracks with about 100 people, all in one dormitory. And on the weekend, if you had the weekend duty, you had to just hang around there. I don't know why, but I had a real good date with a lovely lady over in Dallas, 17, over in Suffolk, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
One day. But I had friends that would answer mustard. And they'd come in and call my name and they'd go, "Here." And I had a backup.
Mm-hmm.
In case there was one guy wasn't there. So when the master at arms came in and held mustard and called my name, three people said, "Here." So I went to captain's mass.
I imagine you did.
They threw me in with great, a while, and the Marine Corps ran the Navy Brig. And while I was in there, they jerked me out in some great hospital, of all places, the Cavalier Hotel in Virginia Beach.
Is that right?
I shared a really lovely corner room with another young fellow. We studied radar. 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, until that school was over. I enjoyed that. I found I was very good at it. And then I immediately signed to a brand new little APD, a high speed airplane squadron, and went out and depth chart in the submarines with me. I only saw one torpedo with me. And a torpedo being shot at us. Went right across, right across the
uh-huh.
We were in a hard right turn, and I'm sure it would hit us.
Yeah.
But I don't know if we ever signed that with any submarine or not. We threw a lot of depth charges and hedgehogs and so forth all over. And we got a couple of oil slicks came up that they would. They knew what they were doing, they'd pump a little oil out just to make people pump it up.
Yeah. Miss Stanley, what was the name of that APD?
It was the APD Upham.
Upham.
99.
Yeah, I was on the Weiss. I think I told you that. That was up on the West Coast.
The Upham. We were in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, on the war was over in the tent.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing. We put the APD in mothballs and Florida. Many place things float.
Hmm.
And then I went to another destroyer for a while and I got discharged from the Navy. It was on the 19th of June. I remember that was because it was the day before my 18th birthday. I've been in the Navy on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I was out of the Navy once in a year. And then July of the next year,
And on the Navy, you were an ET there for a while, correct?
Right at, when I went back in.
Electronics technician for our audience.
When I went back in the Navy, they sent me to New York. They were sort of getting ready, I think, for the Korean War or something.
Mm-hmm.
They had specialists, the personnel specialists, that gave you a battery of tests and all, try to figure out what you're good for. And they wanted to send you to electronics school. But you had to have a high school diploma or pass what they call an EDI test, which was had a lot of good men for me. And I told the specialist that I didn't have a high school diploma. He said, "Well, good way to that, but to pass the test." And I said, "Well, I don't know how I could possibly pass that test, but I didn't any credit or a diploma." So I got assigned to a destroyer And I was on there about 10 days. We got a federal order to go to school. So I got a double waiver.
Yes, right.
And that was an engineering course I had. It lasted 52 weeks, 6 days a week. And it was basically the entire engineering curriculum for electrical engineering, electronics.
Yeah.
I had the same textbooks, Gauss, Hermans, I believe. Good reading.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
Terrific education.
It was very good, and I had two excellent tutors who went through with my two best buddies. They were like a three peas in a pot, and they were very brilliant. They loved me the whole way.
Yeah.
No problem.
I'm sure you were tough to drag through.
Well, we had a good time.
Yeah. Did they stay in like you did?
One of them stayed in, and he was picked up by Admiral Rickover, and the other one didn't stay in, and he went out and got an education, I believe, either GE or Westinghouse picked him up and gave him a college degree. Very, very brilliant.
Well, you hung around with the right people, Frank.
Well, I needed some all the help I could get. Always did.
At this time, was this about the time you married Phyllis, or was this a little later?
I married her. Well, I went back to the same destroyer that left. When I've gone, I've gone 52 weeks, 53 or 4 weeks, about a year. But I wound up right back in the city of Philly. And while I was on there is when I got lost in the little city that crashed the girlfriend's birthday party. But we got married then in 49. And I was on this destroyer, and I'd been on it a couple of 2 years. And then I got married, and I decided I'd go to shorter. My enlistment was on the top. And I put in a request for shore duty, and I was turned down by the, I was in the engineering department since I was in that time. And I was told that I was indisposable, or they needed me, they were going to go to Europe or something, and that I was getting out of the Navy if I wanted to, if I couldn't understand that. So I went to the barber shop, and the captain was in there doing a haircut. And he mentioned, he hoped I was going to re-enlist. I don't know why he was that deep in the personnel, but he knew that my enlistment was coming up. I told him I was going to get out of the Navy because I put in a request for shore duty, and I was turned down. And he said, well, fill out another request and bring it directly to me. And I did. lo and behold, he wasn't more than 2 weeks, and I had a set of orders to be an instructor at Marquette University. That's where I went to. After I went to instructor school, quite a lengthy school. Very good. And I went to Marquette University, almost went to Marquette, Michigan. And I found out that Marquette University was in Milwaukee by chance.
Yeah.
So I wound up the right place.
You made the wrong turn by mistake.
Yeah.
Turned out right. Yeah.
I was there 3 years. Right after I got Marquette, I'd taken a test for research with Kickoff's utility. I promoted my almost to my 10th year. And I really enjoyed the 3 years past 7 years.
Did you make chief while you were up there, or was it after you left Marquette?
Well, it was after I left Marquette. While I was there, I had about 6 months to go. But I wound up teaching the engineering plant at the school of seniors.
Mm-hmm.
I was a senior instructor, assistant. I did a lot of field trips and lecturing and stuff. But the professor of naval science there, a Navy captain, who'd been a submariner during the war, he told the senior instructor I worked for to send me to OCS. So he came down, sat down beside my desk, and told me that what his assignment was. And I looked him right in the eye and said, "Well, we've got our work cut out for us." And he said, "Why is that?" And I said, "Well, you know that you have to have the equivalent of 2 years of college to go to OCS."
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it was then. And he said, "Yeah, I'm aware of that, but I think we can do that." And I said, "But I only have 2 years of high school."
Mm-hmm.
So he said, "Well, you're right." But USAFE, which is the organization for educating military personnel, their headquarters was in Madison, Wisconsin. So we called Madison, and we would go up there and fill out all the papers, get all the tests with the understanding that they would be doctors, and we would hand deliver them, which we did. So that's how I got my high school diploma and picked up the 1 year college equivalent tests, brought them back. They were doctors, and we took them back to Madison and passed all those, got there on the spot, got second year college exams back. We took them, and proctors were getting a little bit scarce, so the captain agreed to doctor a couple of them. And one of them was fine arts.
Hmm.
And I'm looking at these pictures and things, and I said, "Well, I don't know anything about fine arts." He pointed to a picture of Blue Boy, and I said, "Now that's a picture of Blue Boy, but I can't remember who the artist was."
Mm.
And he had about five likely people to pick. And he said, "Well, I can't understand why you need to know anything about fine arts. So I know you can learn how to run a freezer." But he came over, and we went through that test, line item by line item. And between the two of us, we fairly flunked.
Neither one of you knew a thing about fine arts.
Apparently not. I didn't know Gothic architecture from Roman architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So we took those exams back. We failed that. And time was running out. And he asked me if I'd like to go to submarine school, and I said, "I sure would." And he said, "Well, I'll send you, go to submarine school and you can get a commission later on." And by that time, I had a set of orders from Buford, but they needed an electronic technician with my background on the command ship over in the Pacific. So I went to that ship, and it was a huge thing. There were hundreds and hundreds of radios and series and transmitters and radars and monitoring and stuff like that. And I had about 32 electronic technicians working for me. And this captain told me when I left that the submarine force would have me out of there in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right. In 6 months, I had a set of orders to go to submarine school. So that's kind of interesting.
Which coast East Coast, West Coast?
The submarine school or the ship?
The submarine school.
Well, that's in New London, Connecticut.
Okay, that's okay.
Oh,
okay.
Capital of the submarine world.
Right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, we went to New London. And getting out of Japan with them, we didn't want that stuff.
Yeah, sure.
They sent me up to Tokyo. You know, up there in Tokyo, and I went to take a military flight to California. And there's old twin constellations, you know.
Yes.
They had a double tail on.
Yeah, I've flown on a few.
And so we got on there, and most of the passengers were Air Force people.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat right behind an old sergeant, probably a lot younger than I am today, but he seemed like an old guy to me. And we had a young private, I didn't tell. And so we're starting to take off, and we got up in the air. And this private said, "Well, how long do you think it'll be before we get to Hawaii?" And the sergeant said, "We're not going to Hawaii." He said, "Well, that's how we were." He said, "Well," he said, "we're not going to go anywhere." He said, "Well, the pilot will get on the horn here in a minute and tell us we're going back to Japan."
Oh.
Sure enough, about 3 or 4 minutes, he turned around and went back to the airport in Tokyo. And they worked on it for an hour or two. Took off again. We're all in the same seats. And the guy said, "Well, how are we doing?" And the sergeant was about to sleep, and he rolled his head over and said, "We're good for about a half an hour." sure enough, probably 15 minutes, we turned around and went back.
Uh-huh.
And so we landed, and the sergeant got up, and he said, "Well, boys, if we're going to get out of Japan, we're going to have to fix this damn thing ourselves." And they did.
Uh-huh.
And I slept all night long on the bench in the Tokyo airport. And they came around and woke me up and said, "We're ready to go."
Uh-huh.
So we went to Midway Island. And on the way into Midway, the private and the sergeant were talking. And the sergeant assured this private that if they had any sense at all, they would bury that plane on the Midway. So it took me about 2 days. I finally got a ride out of there on an old DC-9, DC-8 or 9. That had been converted to the Holland wounded personnel. It had the Spectre installed.
Mm-hmm.
So I set the Spectre on the Midway to North Field in California. And I caught a B-24 bomber. I had a nose cone and put a shingle. And I set the nose cone. It looked beautiful,
mm.
And I had a general up there flying his profile. I never been on it. But I could listen in to all the conversation. Went down to Riverside, California, up inland from San Diego. And hitchhiked down to San Diego. All I had to do was buy a private, much less money, to get down there to see his girlfriend and get back.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
I was only about 2 or 3 days late. The Phyllis didn't know where I was or how I'd get to anything. And she'd moved, the movers had already moved her out. She was standing there moving.
Mm-hmm.
Everything worked out great.
That's good. That's good.
Right there and the two children and away we went to
London.
Check in on the new one.
Beginning your time as a submariner.
Right.
And it impacted everything you did after that.
More or less. You know, I just sort of fell into all these little deals. I enjoyed submarine school. And there was one captain from Mark Kipley's, where he wanted me down in Key West, Florida, because he wound up as a squadron commander. And he got a letter from him, and I took this the other day. And he was looking forward to seeing me. But the Navy and their wisdom sent me to Norfolk, Virginia, because it had a radar picket submarine. It's 30 foot longer than the normal fleet submarine because they had added a 30 foot section for a pump. So I was assigned to that. And not too long after, we were getting geared up to make a little trip up north of the, just before the Cold War.
Yeah.
And we did a little spook maneuver up to north of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
We played along the way a little bit. We went up and passed up through the English Channel and took the Kiel Canal. I think more or less it's fun in many canals. You know, went into the Copenhagen. Hung around there for a while, and then we went up to Oslo, Norway. Had a really good time in Oslo. And we came out of that field and looked right up around Norway, up into the Barents Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And we had two communication techniques on there. And they were assigned to us to monitor all the telemetry that was gathered. And many radio conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very good, weren't they? But there were some fishing boats up there. And there was a large ship that was pretending to be a mothership for fishing fleet. But they had an array of antennas on board.
These are Russian ships now.
This was a Russian ship, all these Russian boats.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be up on the bridge. I like to get up and get out in the fresh air and there's nothing like that. I was standing look at it. And there was a big black belt of smoke, you know, that thing, and I could tell that people on the way to make it. And it was coming straight at us as far as we could. And we had a division commander. I couldn't believe what happened to me. So, what do you think I could do? And it, you either torpedo him or you die.
So, yeah. He decided to dive.
Diving alarm went
off. Right.
So we cleared the bridge and dove, and that thing came roaring right over.
Is that right?
Yeah, he was looking at me like he had an ice bucket out. He didn't kill me. They would have squashed us if they could have. So we dove and messed around a little bit longer than that. But I think we were probably up there for at least a week in there. And went back to the States, and we were back there for a while. And one of the things that an officer has to do on a submarine, he advanced to exec and then captain, he has to demonstrate acquiring a target and successfully putting all the proper inputs into a torpedo data computer and taking off and successfully firing an exercise torpedo at a legitimate target.
Mm-hmm.
This would be another submarine cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And this was taking place off of somewhere up off of New England. And I used to hang around with the sonar because I was interested, particularly on something like this. I basically only know the building. And I repaired those things anyway. And he was setting up his run. We acquired the target submarine at a bearing of approximately 250, I mean 050, which for the East was.
Mm-hmm.
And he's giving the information to the commissary, the baron, and so forth. And then we've got another unidentified contact to the north. It's probably around 2 or 3 days ago. He reported that, and he was immediately informed that that was probably a side road, or some sort of entry. And not to worry about it, because there wasn't any other submarine command. So he was requested to give a turn count. Now that's the speed of the target's propeller to give the army officer an indication of the speed.
Mm-hmm.
And we were giving them a bearing drift to the right, so we knew the target was probably going some say 180 or in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably 4. We wanted the speed, so we gave him the turn count on the targets that we were tracking. And he also gave him a different turn count on the side load. And we got a sharp response from the conning tower on that. But I knew that there was another target there, and it's telling them I'm good too.
Mm-hmm.
It was definitely. They were going at 2 different speeds. But at any rate, all the information went into the torpedo data computer, and that information was fed into the torpedo, you know, forward torpedo room, and they fired the exercise torpedo. And a sonarman's response when you fire a torpedo is at least to keep the conning tower informed on the behavior of the torpedo. And the proper response would be, or a favorable response, is the torpedo was running hot, straight, normal.
Mm-hmm.
Which he gave after the report. So that exercise torpedo was energized and going straight towards the target where it was supposed to, probably leading the target. And he also reported right after that that the side lobe had fired a torpedo, and his torpedo was running hot, straight, normal directly towards us.
Mm-hmm.
So the conning officer was immediately released by the captain who got on the fine case. And he said, Joe, are you sure our torpedo is running hot, straight, normal to the target? And he said, yes, I am, Captain, and I'm sure that the torpedo that unidentified contact fired is running hot, straight, normal directly towards us. And we could feel the submarine picking up over the speed. So the captain, at this time, was giving that torpedo a broadside shot. Those submarines were 330 feet long, the one we were on.
Mm-hmm.
A little over 330 feet long. So he brought that submarine around directly to the left so that he would give it a bow on shot, which is giving it now a 26-foot target instead of a 330-foot target.
Mm-hmm.
And we no more than got that torpedo swung around, and that torpedo, the unidentified contact target, came roaring down the side, sounding like a freight train. And it was absolutely unbelievably loud.
Wow! Wow!
it definitely broke the monotony, throughout the summer. And, so of course we surfaced and made all sorts of communication. And all that good stuff. And when we pulled into a home port, there was an engineman, his name was Chief Holderfield. He had his bags packed, and he said, enough is enough, because he'd been shot at during the war, World War II, and this peacetime being torpedoed, it wasn't in his, he wasn't going to put up with it.
Uh-huh.
So he left, and he retired. We're going to have a secretary answer the phone in a purple shirt.
This is a call from the Pentagon telling you to shut up, Frank. They know what you're saying. This never made it in the news, did it?
No, it didn't. But Chief Holderfield retired.
Uh-huh.
So that was very interesting. But
I have to think that the torpedo fired by the Soviet sub was
probably a warhead.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know if they were ever able to find it and cover it.
What in the world?
There was a
lot of confrontation out there that people were not aware of during the Cold War.
Some of the stuff they did during the war. I don't know if you'll ever know. Because it was pretty hairy.
Yeah.
And even a little bit that I did. I heard really good stuff. Now, that one I just told you, the National Defense.
About what year would that have been? 55 or so?
Probably 55.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That Cold War era, particularly in the 50s, I think it somewhat after the Cuban Missile Crisis, things started to tone down because it just was getting out of hand. But that was a rough time. People don't know, particularly at sea. The Navy ran into it quite a bit.
And I was on a submarine down there when they were bringing missiles into
Cuba.
Cuba.
Uh-huh.
And, they informed this one cargo ship to turn around and go back, not go in. And I don't know whether we would have had some torpedoes in a minute. But we were there and we had a.
And you were ready.
We were loaded. Were there,
mm-hmm.
and they turned around and went back.
Rough times.
But shortly after that, I was trying to figure out whether I wanted to stay in the Navy again or not. And I was having a bad time with camp, which I can understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why all of a sudden did he take my debts? So I was out on the pier one day, and back then, in those days, Bell Labs in New Jersey was built into there. This engineer strolled over, I worked with him a little bit in the kitchen, and he said, Mac, he said, I'm not allowed to recruit personnel. So I'm on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
He says, but I understand you're going to do up the re-enlistment before too long.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how he found this out?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that's true. He said, well, he says, when you're out, he says, you're interested. He said, I've got a contract in your desk that you can't turn down.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, well, so the next day, the squadron personnel officer, I ran into him, and I knew who he was, but I had no idea how he knew who I was. He called me over and I was going to be enlisted. And I told him, I hadn't made up my mind. And he said, what's wrong? I said, well, I'm a little tired of that submarine I'm on now. But I might go somewhere else. He said, what submarine would go on? I knew there were some guys on the top, and the captain on there was fantastic. It was really a good submarine. I said, well, I might be interested in the cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it. In 2 days, I had a set of orders.
Is that right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm talking to my wife's good girlfriend, who's a bank teller. And she was a very interesting young lady. She had to get rid of her husband. She was married. She had a married wife. But anyhow, I come on. But she was dating the captain on the Red Ten, that was a submarine I was on. And She then, and she was also interested in the engineering office. But on this one date, the last date she had with the captain, I guess she told him that this was a personal. That she wasn't going to date him anymore.
Uh-huh.
This is weird now.
Yes.
He wanted to know why. And she said, well, if you were half the man that Frank Welton was, I'd love to go out with you. And I said, what on earth did she say that for? She says, well, that's what came into my mind. And that was a kiss of death.
Yeah, oh, sure.
So anyhow, I wound up on top, and I had a great time.
Uh-huh.
And shortly after I went there, we were headed for...
And let's just go back one second. That's why you were not getting along with the CEO of the Redfin at that time. All right, just to just to make that point.
So I got off the Redfin and because more or less a threat of leaving the Navy.
Right.
They gave me whatever I wanted.
Right.
And I went to Plainton. I didn't really do anything. And I had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And we were headed for San Juan, Puerto Rico. And I was notified while we were underway that I had made chief, been promoted to chief. Well, all the, on the submarine, all the chiefs on there, they have a big initiation party for the new chief. And one of the things they were supposed to do is throw them over the side.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also an all-NAV order came out, all-Navy order that came out that nobody was to be thrown over the side, particularly on a submarine, because every now and then they beat their head on the hull on the way down. And they have to fish them up. But, so that was, Captain said that absolutely you don't have to do that. We'd love to see it.
They won't throw you over.
Don't throw him over.
Uh-huh.
So they're going to do something else. We pulled into San Juan, Puerto Rico, tied up alongside the Pueblo. And there was a couple of people, two couples, looking like they might be Americans, or Europeans, and they were really looking to slow my name. And the chief that wrote on there was a shark guy. So he went out and was talking to people. And they were putting a brow over and so forth. And they were two people, two couples that worked for Al Strong, one of the farm machinery.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it was all his time. And he invited them aboard. And it was about 11:30. So, him and I and a couple of other chiefs and so forth talked to him. And the chief of that night gave him a complete tour of the submarine. And then there was time for lunch, and we set him lunch. So they invited all the chiefs on the boat to come over to Creed Hilton Hotel for dinner on that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were too close, so we can't do that because we're going to have an initiation for Creed Hilton tonight. And so it's going to be a big party. So they talked about it. Well, what do you do? And this and that. And they said, well, we want to find something. We're going to throw them off the pier or in a swimming pool or something. So we haven't made up our mind. So they couldn't understand why they couldn't have an initiation party to Creed Hilton, which we did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was abandoned. And they had a real nice swimming pool. Sort of in the center of a great big park. And a balcony, you know, and the people were looking down and tables all around. I mean, it was a lot of people. But they dragged me down there to the swimming pool. And four of these chiefs, one on each leg and one on each arm, proceeded to swing me back and forth in uniform, walk and all, right into that swimming pool. And there were quite a few spectators who didn't appreciate it at all. And they were going to So was the other chief. So a lot of fast talking was going on. And so they got out of Tennessee. So I went over and taxi cab and picked me up.
Soaked them wet.
So they had me hide behind the pillars while they held it. Nailed the cab down. Opened the door and
threw you in.
So I went down and changed clothes. This was about midnight. Came back. Joined the park. But that was on Ellis.
There you go.
We were invited back. I spent many a 2 or 3 days over there with those people, and so did the ministers. And you got Christmas card coming to you.
That's great. That's great.
Pretty good experience.
Now, we kind of have to move on here. I don't know how much more time you spent as a submariner. Was it a number of years or a relatively short time?
I left that submarine and went to the instructor school at Naval School Command in Norfolk. And I was there for, this was in 59 rolled in. There were two chief electronic technicians at the radio school. We can all acknowledge that. And we also taught basic electronics to the radio. And that's when the E89 program came. And that was two additional pay grades. Chief was E7, and E8 and E9 was invented for the military. Sergeants and people. So, and we didn't get a lot of, too many things, myself and other one. We were sort of frowned on by the radio because we didn't pay any attention to it. And we didn't think that we would be recommended for E8 or E9. And the other EP, his name is Baker, he used to be our first nominee. And he said, I know how we can force them into recommending us to get HDA. I said, how is that? He said, we'll trick them into recommending us to take the LDO exam to be promoted to ensign. And so I said, okay, we'll do that. So he went down and he stopped and said, about recommending because he knew that it looked good for the command that would recommend all these people to take the ensign. They said, oh, sure, you'll have to do all the paperwork. Well, this was right down here now. He could type this fast and the secretary of the mentor, and he knew the books personally. So he did all the paperwork. He's over there in a typewriter working like mad, filling these papers up. I'm working on a transmitter trying to get it to work, and for the bench stuff. And he's asking me questions so he can fill out my papers. And he said, I'm not too interested. He said, what are your hobbies? And I said, I like woodworking and automobile repair and improved cars. And I said, I think they said broad jumping or something like that. And he said, yeah, I got that. Bridge, golf, and tennis.
Right. All the appropriate hobbies.
He did all the paperwork.
Right, right.
And there was probably 140 or so people in the school's command at North, it's a big operation. All these different schools. Took the LDO exam. And I believe that year there were only 5 picked up. Both of us. The ET that filled out the papers.
Is that right?
And myself.
Right. Right.
And then a friend of mine that worked as a teletype repairman at the teletype school. We were real good.
You knew them all. You knew probably all of them. Now, people don't realize, if you haven't been in the service, I know this, that come up as a LDO Mustang, we called them Mustangs, was considerable was quite an achievement. This was a career route in the service that only the very best people ever got into. I know that as a fact because I worked with them when I was in the Navy, and it's a testimony to the quality individual that you were and that you were recognized as such. I would like to kind of get to the point where you leave the Navy, and then because of your experience as in the submarines, semi-submersibles, submersibles, those sorts of things, you end up a Global Marine. Now, I know we're jumping ahead a decade or so, but you end up a Global Marine, and you end up the master and let's call it commander of several of their vessels, some of the largest, most expensive ships and vessels that ever went to sea, ever made by man. And you were the master of those vessels. So let's kind of talk a little bit about that, because I want people to realize that all that background in your life led to another experience. It had to do, of course, with oil. Ultimately, that's who was paying the bill for these very expensive ships. So why don't we just, because we only have about 7 or 8 minutes here left, let's just kind of get into that and let people know about that part of your life.
Well, I was commissioned in June. Gets to June the 2nd, but I was never recommended to you.
You missed out on that.
So I had quite an interesting experience in submarines as an officer. I got qualified as an officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a division engineer for submarines and Submarine Hotel 1 in San Diego, and did a couple of very, I was also the special project. I did a couple of very interesting special projects. I designed a communication system, and I did a torpedo evaluation, picked the crew, and put the submarine to sea, and had all the people get off, and we had to build it up to top speed for the chute, which meant that the two men I had on board with me and the three of us departed in a UDT boat where the submarine was going about 15 miles an hour.
No longer manned, of course.
So, you know, I had all those people and took them off. And that turned out really well. And then I got into computerized warfare at the NEL in the contract and worked on those projects. And I transferred to the Compass Island, which was attached to the scientific lab at Brooklyn, New York.
That's a ship now.
A large converted merchant ship.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I can talk about that I did there was development of GPS.
Yes.
So I had a civilian engineer and several electronic technicians working for me, and how we were developing that. And that was an interesting topic. And
all these GPS units these people carry around today in their pocket, you guys were the early research people.
The one I worked on was about the size of the refrigerator.
Yeah.
But it didn't necessarily have to be that it was easy to work with and change and so forth. But it was just a very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to San Diego and worked designing combat information centers.
Mm-hmm.
And then I left the Navy. While I was designing and installing these installations at the laboratory, I had a young engineer report because we were short with an engineer. And he was rented from Global Man Engineer. And he used to bring me drawings, and I can remember one. He said, "Is there anything wrong with this this blueprint. And I took one look at it about five seconds. I said, I don't see an analog to digital converter in there. And he said, there isn't. And I said, well, that's what's wrong.
Yeah, right.
But he was amazed that I picked that up so quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So later on, I was looking for a job when I left the Navy. And I called him to ask him a question for another man who was looking for a job. And he wanted to know what I was doing. And I said, I'm looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, hang on a minute. I thought he was having to ask the phone or something. But the next thing I knew, the guy said, well, my name's Maury Levovitz. I'm the Vice President for Engineering for Global Marine.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, if you're looking for a job, I want to talk to you.
Great.
So I went over and handled with him for a while.
Yeah.
I went to work for Global Marine Engineering. And I got the job I wanted. It was very nice. But run around all over the world practically inspecting ships that had problems and figuring out what they needed to do in the shipyard. And then making a report out in about a week and going back something else. But then they gave me a job. They wanted me to write maintenance books for fire control radar. And man, I didn't think of anything more boring than that. So I quit Global Marine after about a year and bought a third of a woodworking company. And the man that owned two thirds of it started easing me behind the desk. And I could see the handwriting on the wall. So we had a little conversation and he said that he wasn't going to sit behind the desk all the time. And I had to do at least my share.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, at least my share would be 3/4 of the time I'd be doing the book. Mm-hmm. Yes, going core samples all the way from Florida to New England.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll edit this now.
So, go back to an important question for one.
Yeah, let's go back to that, Frank. We'll go back to Phyllis. You saying what you like to do.
Right.
You like seeing the sun come up at sea and those sorts of things. And she said, why don't you go back? So that's what we'll do. That's where we'll go. Yeah. Just say go.
And you know, just started out by a bunch of things that I do, but it's up to you to talk about
it. Right.
When am I going to know when we're going to talk?
When I start to talk, we're on.
Okay, if you're the one hanging around,
Was there anybody on my phone?
Yes, I wrote a message. The message is
Well, Frank, you, for a short time there, had, you owned a wood working company.
Yeah.
And it required some desk time that neither you or your partner really wanted to put in.
That's right.
So it was time for a career change.
Yeah.
Why don't you explain how that happened?
Although I enjoyed working with all the oak and walnut that we used, I just sold my third of the company back.
Mm-hmm.
Phyllis decided that we probably should do something that I enjoyed doing. And she wanted to know if I ever did anything that I enjoyed doing. I had to get it clarified that whether it was while I was earning money or whether I was recreating.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know what I'm talking
about. Mm-hmm.
And I told her I enjoyed watching the sunrise in the morning and a 4-day egg watch and the sunset in the evening and the 4-day.
At sea.
Sea. She said, well, why don't you go run a ship somewhere? So I went down to the Coast Guard station in San Diego and talked to the warrant officer there, right, at the exam center, and he told me that that's great. If you'd have been here a week later, I wouldn't be able to count your Navy point.
Hmm.
And he said that if you're under the curtain, if you do the paperwork right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we did. And they ran a scan through the viewfers and all the records and so forth, and all my sea time and what I did and so forth. And they informed me that if I could sit as either a second deck officer and a third engineer, or I could sit as a second engineer and third deck officer. I wasn't interested in the deep ones and getting work. So, they, set up to take the second week test.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought I could do in with the old police.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out from a gentleman that ran a school up in San Francisco, who was a master mariner, and he told me the only way to find out what I needed to know was take the test. And I took that test. The test was 3 days. 3.5 days, actually. 2 to 3 hours in the morning and 2 to 3 hours in the afternoon. For 3.5 days.
Mm.
And half of that, the only thing they had to do with navigation to take the flight had to be 90% better.
Mm.
That's. So they really waited and got pretty quick. And then after, and there was all kinds of things. You had to have entering a little bit of international law and so forth, and international rules of law. And you had to read a flashing light and interpret what, you know, in the international signal book, what that meant and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I often wondered what those midship and gets 4 years at the
academy.
At the academy,
mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
The main maritime and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, maybe I can do this in six months. But it took me almost a year before I learned enough celestial navigation.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of trigonometry involved. Of course, I learned that in a few weeks, but so I finally got my second deck officer glasses, and then a list of 6 shipping places in L.A. that I go visit. And the first off ramp I came to took me right into the Global Marine House. So I went in there, and I learned
from how to get a job. And I went in and talked to the receptionist. And I told her who I wanted to see, who I knew was the VP for personnel. And she said, you have an appointment. I said, not exactly. He told me to come soon. So she handed me an application to fill out. She said, well, you fill this application out, and if we can use you, we'll call you for an interview. And I said, you don't seem to understand. I came here to see Mike Mell.
Mm-hmm.
So that we paid for him. I said, he told me to come to see him. I got my meets list. And I'm here, and I'm going to see him. She said, well, you can't see him. I said, why not? She said, well, he's on vacation. And I said, well, I intend to see whoever he left in charge. And she really took off, and she stomped off. They think she came back and said, Mr. Hansen will talk to you in camp.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they sat down and wrote about one paragraph on Offshore Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
She came in and said, good city. Now, Global Marine is a worldwide oil exploration company. I went in and talked to him for a few minutes, and he called her in and said, I want you to bring me a blank 2-year contract. We haggled around a while, and she said, she wanted me to leave that day, but I said, I'm good. So, she came in and put the contact, and I think told her to call Dr. So-and-so because I had to get a physical immediately. So we figured out what I was going to make and so forth. She wanted me to leave, and that day, I said, well, I have to get a sextant. I'm a sextant. She said, you have to have a sextant. I said, yeah, I can't go to see the whole sextant. And I did. And he said, why not? I said, well, does a cowboy need a saddle?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, all right, can we reach San Diego tomorrow morning?
Mm-hmm.
So I went out to get the cab to go to the doctor. And the secretary, the receptionist, said, I guess this is your lucky day. I said, well, I'll know a lot more about that in about a week.
Yeah.
And she said, but I hate to do this, but you really do have to fill out this application.
Uh-huh.
And I said, all right. Well, I went over it, and I filled out next to kin and address and phone number, everything that I felt that she actually had to have. And I gave it back, and I said, is this all you need? She looked up, and she said, yes, that's it. So I got the physical, and I went to Savannah, Georgia, and I met people, and that was really unbelievable. To be able to go to sea with a bunch of characters on there. They had a contract with USGS to drill 4 samples, all the way from Florida up to Maine. And they had USGS personnel on there.
That's geological survey.
Geological, this whole mass.
Right.
And apparently, there were 4 girls, women, and 4 men, and they worked the laboratory, checking the samples up, slicing them up, and keeping half of them in the refrigerator. And it appeared to me that they had women from Alaska, the Midwest, Florida, and they'd be on there for 2 weeks and they'd leave. And it appeared to be the favorites of whoever was in charge of one place or another. You know, the one gal on there was in Woods Hole. I knew that she could stay on there as long as she wanted. So the director of that project, Dr. Hathaway, he thought she was one. But anyhow, when that was over, I took the ship to we went back down to some port in Mississippi, Gulf Port, Mississippi. And then later on, I was called to several other ships to Cleveland Avenue. And then they were going to commission a big new drill ship to go in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And they put me on that. And I was on that ship for approximately 7 years. Four of those years I was a master.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they found out that I passed the master's exam, I got it was informed by the Coast Guard before I knew it. And I was on vacation here in Franklin at the time, meeting my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And they called me to West Coast or Pacific for the manager called me down to see me in the airport. As soon as I could get there, I told him, yeah, I could do that. He said, well, I got a ticket for you. It's a Franklin Airport right now.
Mm-hmm. These folks didn't fool around, did they?
So I met Leon Burton at the airport,
uh-huh,
in Long Beach, and he took me out to lunch, and we enjoyed ourselves, and took care of it, and jumped on a helicopter and went out to the Grand Pacific where we leave the captain.
Mm-hmm.
And I transferred him to the Beaumont Land. And that made the staff on the manager of the Beaumont Land mad because he had planned on me being the captain.
Is that right?
He had talked to me about that earlier.
Yeah, right.
And I told him, well, ever pass the test, I wouldn't care.
Right.
But, his boss had me in something else.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed on there until, and we drilled oil wells in the Santa Barbara Channel off of the Vandenberg Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And through Panama Canal up to the off of the
North Sea.
Off of the New Jersey and the Baltimore Channel.
Oh.
Drilled a real
top-rated well. Yeah, you don't hear much about that. Uh-huh.
The Exxon had a 5-year contract on that ship.
Uh-huh.
And that 5 years was up, they extended it for another thing.
Uh-huh.
When I left, we were making about 75,000 on that ship.
Uh-huh.
And that was net. It was very interesting. And the technology was terrific. And that ship was about a little over 450 feet long, 72 feet wide, and the barrack itself is 140 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
You can barely get under the road to get there. You have to go in low tide,
yeah,
right in the sun. Good for duty. And then my son-in-law wound up on that ship just by a fluke. He's a chief engineer. And he was complaining down there in the Gulf of Mexico that one of his men who got promoted from the chief engineer, they sent him to the North Sea. Now, that's foreign duty, you'd make more money. He was really upset to think that they would send one of his people and not him to the North Sea.
Uh-huh.
And I told him, I said, listen, if I was in personnel, I had a chief engineer like you that was very popular. I wouldn't want to make him mad by sending him off to a foreign job. And he's happy to all get out living right outside of Yosemite Park in California. I said, I wouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if you want to go to the North Sea, you got to ask him. And he said, I don't think that's the way they would. I said, there's the phone, buddy.
Pick it up.
Or shut up.
Right.
He picked it up, and he called him, he talked, and he talked, and he said, finally, he hung up, looked at me with a bewildered expression on his face, said, I'm going to the North Sea.
There you go.
He was gone maybe a month, and I got to settle with it. Because of my friend in the, on the news to cover the Pacific, he was promoted to go up Aberdeen and take the North Sea and all of that. That was pretty big for Northern Solutions.
Oh, my.
So they drug me over there. I went initially to Port Finland, where they were building three party-class semi-submersibles. They'd already built one, and I went, I was made captain of a Arctic 2. And it was still under final
inspection.
Finishing up the construction. I was getting a lay of the land and getting to know everybody. I was there about 2 weeks. And then, I was called in off the ship, and the manager told me that the Exxon had fit, and I had to go back to Walmart for six.
Is that right?
So, and, so, I packed up my bag and went back to Walmart for six. And I told the, missile the vice president of the whole geology organization of Exxon. And with his superintendent on the ship, he was a really gentleman. He was very confident. I told Junior Westbrook that I didn't mind coming back because of the hurricane season was just starting to be. I said, I can understand his concern. I'm surprised he paid that much attention. Actually, critical.
Yes.
And I said, well, when this hurricane season's over, I said, Global Marine's not going to pick up the extra $1,500 that I missed now. And I said, well, I don't think Exxon is willing to do that either. But I would love to make a little more money. Which I understand. As soon as that hurricane season was over, I was off to the North Sea and took command of it. Of a ship over there, one of the Arctic class semi-submersibles, they put me on the one, the Queen Arctic one.
Mm-hmm.
And, I wanted to take Phyllis over there, but she didn't want to go. And, so I got off the ship and was heading back to, San Diego. And, Leon Burton, the area manager, he said, I want to take you out to my house and show you my house. He had a really nice house on there. He said, we're going on vacation for a couple of months back to the States to take care of some things. He said, I want you to bring Phyllis over here. I want you and Phyllis to live in this house until we get back.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we're going to leave in about a month.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'll have her here.
There you go. There you go.
So that was it. That was how I got Phyllis out of San Diego.
And you got it at Aberdeen, Scotland. This is where this was all based. Yes.
And we lived there, and he let the office know to find your place to live.
Uh-huh.
So we, when Leon got back and settled in, Phyllis and I had to go out and live in this cheap house that they were in, supposed cheap and. He washing dishes and looking out a kitchen window right at this big, beautiful golf course.
It was rough, wasn't it?
We were right on the golf
course. It was really rough.
Really nice course.
Aberdeen, Scotland at that. Think about it.
And we enjoyed Scotland. We were there about 3 months. And it dawned on us that if we were going to be in British waters, the British property, for more than 6 months out of the year, we had to pay income tax. And my income bracket would be about 60% of my income tax I'd have to pay the
British government.
British government. So we went down to Europe and bought a European car, and we were driving up and around and thinking about going down there, and maybe Brussels built. That's where we bought the car. And I knew a guy in Boston. And I know some people telling me I should go to Spain. But I, doing an inspection on the ship one day, and I saw a brochure for Shopper Now, Austria, up in the Alps. And that's where my rig mechanic that took care of the frames and the air compressors and stuff, he lived there. So I asked him, I didn't know what side of the Iron Curtain was, because this one was still the Iron Curtain.
Mm-hmm.
He said there was no reason whatsoever. I could live there all I wanted, all no problem. I said, where could I live? He said, I'll call my mother. She has a flat on the second floor of her house. And she rents out to hikers and skaters and stuff. So he called her, and she said, yeah, they'd put me up. So now that was a Mellau hospital. Now the German electrician who showed me the brochure to start with, he told me that Victor's mother's house was even, their home was even better. Mellau was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that once I got to a certain city, that go up between the mountains because there's only one road and it goes right to
nothing.
So Phyllis and I went over there and found this place, and it was beautiful. Absolutely gorgeous. And Victor's parents were wonderful. So we stayed there for a few years. And to, as luck would have it, I just had one luck afternoon. I moved the rig to the Irish Sea. From an out of British waters. I'm out of Great Britain.
Right.
Out of Scotland.
Right.
And I was only there about 5.5 months.
Yeah, is that right? Is that right?
Yeah. And the way they, in Austria, it turned out, I didn't even ask, but the way they work is if you work in Austria, you have to pay Austrian taxes. Or if you work in any country bordering Austria, you have to pay income tax.
Mm.
But if you work elsewhere, like China or the North Sea, they're glad to have you come back and spend the money. So no income tax before.
Right.
That worked out great.
Sure.
So we're drilling away one day out there, right off of a fairly shallow water, about 300 feet, off of Aberdeen. And we had a blowout. A kick is when you get a blast of oil, and because your mud weight isn't right or whatever, and the gas pressure is higher than you anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
You could lose some of your mud because it was lower than you expected. You get a big blast of the oil and gas coming. And that's controlled with a blowout.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a blowout. I mean, a full-blown blowout. And one of the tool pushers went to work on the blowout because it wasn't operating properly from a control station. Probably because, well, the company man has one, and he was trying to close the blowout together. The driller was trying to close from his station, and it's not doing anything.
Yeah, it's interfering.
So the senior tool pusher went down to the VOP control room, and he cut everybody off, and he was operating in his own down there. And the other tool pusher called Phillips, we were drilling for Phillips. We called the Phillips man in Aberdeen and told him that we had a blowout. And he starts giving him a lecture on the difference between a kick and a blowout. And so the tool pusher cut him off and he said, what the hell do you call it when you've got oil and gas flying over the chrome block in the top of the derrick?
Right.
So that ended that lecture.
No, yeah, right.
And he told them to get a helicopter out there because they had such a blast of oil and mud and shale and stuff coming into the shale shaker room that it blew two men right out the back entrance of this shale shaker room and down the down those iron steps.
Yeah.
Just, and they were really beat up there.
Yeah.
And they put them in the fire and the wake.
Uh-huh.
And the company man came in to the bridge. Now this is a fact. And he had a parka. You know, this was in probably February, early
March. Cold.
And he come in there with his arms stretched out, total panic, waving them around, and he was covered with mud. All over, parka and all. And the only thing I could see that wasn't chocolate covered was his eyeballs.
Yeah.
And he's hollering, "Get us out of here, Cap! Get her on our way!" And you know, these things had two powerful screws. You could go whenever you wanted.
Right.
But you'd have to dump chains.
Right.
So he wants me to get underway, and then he went down and got in the lifeboat. And that's why the tool pusher had to call Phillips instead of him, because he was in the lifeboat.
Yes.
He was out of the picture all
right,
the time.
Right, right.
Anyhow, I wasn't about to get underway because I got everything rigged up, you know, the technical stuff. I had to release the pawls back after 8 chains in the water, 8 inches, 30, 45 degrees. And I was going to dump the 4 back aft and just take off. Just rip the BOP and the riser and everything right out of there. But it was a horrible, horrible disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything started a fire, then a wildcat with a chain going over, it would just be like lighting a cigarette.
Giant torch.
I didn't want to do that.
Right.
So I was giving that tool pusher all the time we could. And that was probably the most intelligent decision I ever made, was to ignore that company superintendent and everybody else who wanted to get the heck out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even want the engines and the lifeboats to go off. So they were hanging underneath the helicopter, about 60 feet off the water. So anyhow, we finally got that blowout, so then I had to start the move, and it gently shut off.
Huh.
Instead of a mud blasting clear up into the crown block,
uh-huh.
Crown block was 160 feet up off the mill block.
Right.
And when I went back aft to to disengage some pawls on the chain so I could flip the switch on the bridge and dump them.
Right.
There was at least an inch deep all the way back aft of this mud. And the closer you got to the derrick, the deeper the mud. You got about 3 inches deep.
Uh-huh.
The amazing thing is, and you'd never expect this, but the color of it was a dark, like incandescent green, dark green sparkle.
Is that right?
And that was because of the gas in there. There was liquefied gas came out with the mud.
Yes, yes.
So the pressure down there was about 16,000 pounds per square inch is what they yield into. And that was blowing it up. They had registered 7,000 pounds per square inch on the choke and fill manifold on the drill bit.
Uh-huh.
And this was big.
Immense. That's immense.
And it was, but hey, there was no rust on that rig for a while. It was covered.
This turned out to be a great producer, but would have had to, right?
Oh, yeah. It was all the. Practically all those places.
Tremendous. Tremendous. Tremendous.
Because the geological work they did before they were sampled and figure out where they want to put the production platform. But the helicopter came out with a doctor, and by that time, all this green stuff had gone because enough of the gas had boiled out, they just left it a nice chocolate and mellow.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't tell you that. But when the guy came in waving his arms, uh-huh. To get underway, he looked exactly like a gingerbread man. You know,
yes.
He looked like a handmade
gingerbread
man. Yeah, I had to laugh. I laughed and said, "I'm getting after it. And I'll get her underway when I'm ready."
Mm-hmm.
But then he came in after it was all shut down in there, and then he'd come roaring back in and say, hold her, Temple. Yeah, I'm holding her. But it took quite a while to get it shut down. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was the right decision to make. Mm-hmm. And then it's Bob Myers, the pool pusher, senior pool pusher. He's the one who saved it. Because if he didn't know that blowout preventer at the back of his home, he would have never been able to circumnavigate the problem that happened. Mm-hmm. There's some seals down there that were de-energized, and the hydraulic fluid flowed right out of the BOP into the city.
Yes.
And he had to route some hydraulic fluid from something else in there and get it into those rams quick enough to get them shut.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out real good.
He knew what he was doing.
Well, and they had to hire, they hired six Mauritians, the Mauritius Islands, and they're down in there. The Indian Ocean. Well, they had some people clean up, six of them, specifically to clean up it. And it was a massive job.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty nice guy, huh? I enjoyed working with them.
Okay, then, Frank. Well, Frank.
And then, after that, I got a job, they had a slowdown. We laid a lot of people off and stacked a lot of roots towards the end. I was 86.
Yes.
And I went to see for a company that had a contract with the Defense Mapping Agency. And that was a large research ship. And they had a big, powerful helicopter on there. 16-man crew, including the three helicopter pilots. Four survey boats, and I had a civilian crew of 50, and the Navy had a complement of about 175. Quite a few. Half of that in the Civil Service.
Yeah.
And very interesting. Primarily in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
We had to work out a bit out of Singapore, the Darwin, Australia, this place.
Well, when we started this conversation, I mentioned, for the benefit of our audience, that you're a guy who's seen the world like nobody else I actually know. And I've seen a lot of it. You know that from my time in the Navy. You've been everywhere. You've done so many things that most people aren't even aware are happening in the world. You've had quite a life. I think Phyllis really made the right decision when she said, you do what you like to do, and you made that final decision to go become a mate to the Coast Guard. Your guys basically made choices in life that turned out to be great ones. You had an extraordinary life. I think we are very fortunate that you decided after all this was done, and it seemed like you took several times to retire from Global Marine, you end up coming back to Franklin, and you've become such a major part of the Franklin community. Everybody's active now with the Debents and places like that, the Kiwanis, that as you were when you were actually at sea. It's really, we're very fortunate to have you, Frank, and I think anybody in Franklin would say that anybody in the general oil region up in Oil City, up in Titusville, you're just one of those guys. You did it. You were a doer. You did it. And it's a pleasure to hear your stories about all the things that happened. And I want to thank you for the community, from the standpoint of the community, for the life you've led, the fine family you've had, and the fact that you've retired to this area and you've done so much for this area since you've come back. So I really want to thank you very, very much, Captain.
I want to thank my wife for putting up with me.
Yes.
At the end of this month, we're going to celebrate our 60th anniversary.
Is that right? Oh, that's great. That's great.
And she didn't even leave me. And one day the phone rang here in 91.
Uh-huh.
And one of the my friend down in Houston, Texas, said they had a ship in the South China Sea that, and there was a super typhoon coming in, and they thought the captain was going to have nervous breakdown, and they wanted me to go out there. I said, no problem. And so were your tickets in the Franklin Airport. So the next morning I went out there and flew over to the Philippines, and they met me at the airport and flew me to, out to some little island off the western coast and took a helicopter out, took them out of that ship until after the typhoons were all gone. We had to disconnect and move the ship. And she didn't even complain about that. And she didn't know until after I got back why I left.
Why?
Well, I guess she was used to things like that.
Yeah. You've told me the crew, when you arrived, the crew was very nervous on that ship. And they said, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I think you said something to the effect, we're heading south. Where? To the equator. There aren't any typhoons along the equator. Right? Isn't that, wasn't that your scheme?
Well, we evacuated everybody that was non-essential, except the chief steward and his guy. And he refused to go. And so I had him come up and say, why aren't you knew where any of your people going? He said, anybody in your right mind knows that the safest place within 1,000 miles of here is wherever you're at, and I'm not leaving.
Right.
He said, why would I want to go
right
inland and get blown around? And you know you're going where? He said, we got a lot of faith in you. He said, my gang's not leaving.
There you go. So right.
The rest of it.
Well, we all have a lot of faith in you. We always have, and
This community, this community is loaded with really nice people. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. And I appreciate all the people, and like you and your wife, and the whole organization with the Royal 150, and the people in Kiwanis Club, and the people that run the Dance Antique Music World, and the Bonanza County Historical Society, and the churches. I mean, it's a great place to live.
Yes, it is.
And you'll enjoy it.
Well, we're very fortunate that you and Phyllis decided to stay here. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Very welcome, believe me.
Is this a cut?
Yeah, it's cut. It's cut. That worked out pretty well, didn't it?
Yeah.